Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Listeners, thanks for joining me. I just had the most incredible discussion with Mr. Gary Nesner. We've been on a series lately about the good, the bad, and the ugly in negotiations, and he was talking about what did not go well at the Waco crisis. It certainly in North America and perhaps the world is one of the most, if not the most, talked about and dangerous situations that negotiators and the public have ever been in. He speaks about what went wrong and what could have been done differently to fix it. And that kind of wisdom, you can't teach in books. You've got to experience that kind of stuff for yourself to be able to get it. And getting it straight from the guy who was there, you cannot put a price on that kind of teaching. So I am thrilled to be able to share this episode with you. I think it's amazing, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Enjoy. Good afternoon, Gary. How are you?
I'm great, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Oh, man, I'm so excited to have you on. You are a legend. You are a legend in the space, and having you on the show again to share your wisdom is a really big deal for us because we've been doing a series on sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to negotiation and things that people have experienced. And I know that you've been through a number of incredible negotiations that have gone splendidly well, and then a few negotiations that didn't go splendidly well. So I definitely want to talk to you about that and get your in-depth views about what went right and what went wrong. But before we get into that, for the people who don't know you, maybe you could share a little bit of background as to who you are and what you do.
All right. Well, I retired from the FBI after a 30-year career in 2003, and I was a negotiator, bosses negotiator for 23 years of that 30-year career, and I was the chief of the FBI's crisis negotiation unit for the last 10. So I ran the entire worldwide program for the FBI, which involved about 350 negotiators in the FBI's field offices around the country. And in that capacity, my unit, the crisis negotiation unit, responded to incidents domestically, prison riots, embassy sieges, hijackings, prison riots, right-wing militia standoffs. If there was an international event, we would respond, such as the event in Lima, Peru, against the Japanese ambassador's residence that I flew down for. And we worked kidnappings of American citizens abroad, and I worked about 120 of those in one capacity or another. That was a pretty fulfilling and enriching opportunity to run that unit and to be operational as well as instructional, and to have the luxury to have a team of full-time negotiators where we could also conduct research and put together instructional curriculum for essentially the entire negotiation community throughout the world. And after retiring, I joined Control Risk, an international risk consultancy, and worked overseas kidnappings for clients. And following that, I just wrote my book, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, and also was involved in last year's six-part Waco miniseries put on by the Paramount Network. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I've been around the business for quite a long time and have greatly benefited from the things that I've done, as well as the experiences of other great negotiators out there who I've had the pleasure to work with and learn from and share with.
Love it, man. I think for a lot of people who don't know who you are, they probably still know your story because of the miniseries that's been developed on the Waco crisis and all that kind of stuff, which sort of might lead as a good segue into my first question, which is your career spans so much. I mean, you've done so much, you've seen so much, and in your background, there's probably been a negotiation that didn't go the way that you wanted it to go. I would assume that was what happened at Waco. Can you walk us through what was the primary reason? Like, why didn't it go the way it should have gone? And what was going on at the time, and what could we learn from that?
Yes, you're correct, Mark. Waco would certainly, heads down, be the most traumatic event I was involved in, or maybe anybody's been involved in.
Yeah.
You know, it started in February of 1993 when a different federal agency, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, attempted to arrest David Koresh and execute a search warrant on a compound, as it were, a religious group called the Branch Davidians and its leader, David Koresh. And their legal justification was that the group had been illegally modifying weapons and selling those. There was also reports of child abuse and some other charges. So they decided to conduct a raid and an arrest. They planned it out. They brought in a lot of people. And as they were ready to execute the arrest, word slipped out that they were coming. And so the Davidians were expecting them. And when the ATF pulled up in front of the compound, a firefight ensued. Both sides claimed the other shot first. It was a massive firefight, the largest gun battle in the United States since the Civil War. And four ATF agents were killed, 17 were wounded, and four or five Branch Davidians were killed as well. So a pretty terrible situation. Despite that, they were able to secure a ceasefire. And once that occurred, the FBI was brought in to manage the situation, regardless of which federal agency is involved. If a federal agent is murdered, it falls to the jurisdiction of the FBI to investigate. So, and because of the FBI's significantly larger resources and experience, we were brought in. So the negotiations proceeded. Very challenging to start off a situation with so much loss of life and so much animosity. David Koresh was himself wounded, and he was obviously very angry at the government and particularly ATF. But despite that, I had a great negotiation team. We employed a lot of patience and understanding. We were able to secure the release of a lot of children in the early days. Several days into it, Koresh had promised to surrender if we broadcast a nationwide message that he'd recorded. And we wanted a recorded message because we wanted to be able to listen to it and make sure it wasn't a precursor for suicide. We showed it to religious scholars, and they had no issues with it that would be of concern. So I convinced the on-scene commander to play it on the promise that Koresh would surrender after we did that.
Right.
So the message was broadcast on the Christian Broadcast Network, national broadcast. And despite that, Koresh changed his mind, didn't come out. And while this was disappointing to the negotiation team, it's not unexpected. And of course, it sort of hurt my position with the boss for a little bit because he wanted to know, was there a clear quid pro quo? If we played the tape, was he definitely going to surrender? And I indicated that, well, we hoped he did, but that I couldn't guarantee it. But more importantly, the reason I advocated for the playing of the tape was I felt as though we had nothing to lose. But despite that, he didn't come out. That created an awful lot of anger. You know, in the negotiation courses, the first thing we talk about that I've always taught is self-control. If you have any hope of influencing the behavior of someone else, you first have to have your own behavior in check. Again, while negotiators, myself certainly, were disappointed, the on-scene commander and the tactical commander were enraged and allowed that anger and feeling they had been duped to drive their decision-making. And so they implemented some very aggressive external movements and activities that only tended to ratchet up further the response of the Davidians. So instead of getting back on track and using it as leverage, for example, saying to Koresh, hey, I made this happen for you. I put my neck out on your behalf and you didn't come through. So you kind of owe me, you know, reciprocity, yeah. A principle we always believe in. But instead, when we manifested an angry response, it only allowed Koresh to get angry back at us. So things got out of kilter for some days. The negotiation team brought it back around. Obviously, we have time limitations here, but we were able to get things moving again and secure the release of additional people. And then again, disappointments were met, and the tactical team, again, without coordinating with the negotiators, took aggressive action that, you know, resulted in us having our position undercut. Long story short is I was there for the first half of the 52 days and running the negotiations, during which time we got out 35 people, including, I believe, 21 children. And quite proud of that, but disappointed that we couldn't get more out. And I think part of that was because, certainly unintended, but the FBI was sending mixed signals. And that created a lot of trust problems between our negotiation team and the Davidians. After all, who are you going to believe, the nice man on the phone or the guy driving the tank that just crushed your car in the front yard? So
right. You
can imagine the challenges we had there. So the big disappointment was, and you know, I tell people that it was difficult for me to get David Koresh and my boss to think clearly at the same time.
Right.
You know, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So At Waco, we had excellent resources, every asset and resource of the FBI available to us. Yet some bad decision-making, a failure to have adequately trained our decision-makers on how the process works, led to a lot of problems that were eventually impossible to overcome. Now, I was seen clearly as an impediment to a stronger tactical approach. There was thinking that the way to get the Davidians to comply was to ratchet up the pressure, to increase the external pressure, to force them out. I and my negotiation team knew that that would be counterproductive. It's the paradox of power. The harder you push, the more likely you are to get resistance. But eventually, they decided to replace me with someone else to lead the team, the second half, who was a little bit more compliant to the tactical efforts, and no one else came out during the rest of the siege until the day of the fire, when there was a handful that came out when the building was in flame. So it was a terrible event, obviously. I think in fairness, it's a complex event. There are people in the United States that are sort of anti-government oriented and feel as though the government just came in and wanted to kill everybody and exercise no patience. And that's certainly a false narrative. But that does not mean that the FBI did not make some serious mistakes. And in fact, I just did an interview the other day and someone asked me, what did we learn from Waco? And I said, the primary lesson is to have done what we always did before Waco. I viewed Waco as not so much that the FBI didn't know what to do, but rather we departed from what we knew what to do. So there was obviously a lot of internal inquiries, congressional investigations. I testified before Congress twice myself. There was several inquiries that looked into various aspects of the siege. And while the FBI tended to defend itself in the eyes of the public, internally there was a clear recognition that we had failed in the management area. So after Waco, the on-scene commander and the tactical commander were essentially encouraged to retire, and I ended up getting a promotion out of it. So there was a clear recognition within the FBI that we had it right, which segues into, I know, another question, and stop me if I get ahead of myself, but probably the best situation I had, and one that your readers may not have heard about, was 3 years following Waco. We had an 85-day long siege in Montana against an anti-government group called the Freemen. And fortunately, this one did not begin with violence, but there were some violent people in there, and the threat was real and genuine. And of course, all eyes were on the FBI to see how we would manage this event, mindful of how Waco had ended so tragically. This case was different in that now the director of the FBI, who was not the director during Waco, Louis Free, basically told me, he said, take your time, do this the right way. And in Montana, the negotiation team was allowed to devise the strategy that was followed. And while it took 85 days, it was a peaceful surrender. No one was hurt. And of course, because of that, it became a non-news item. While it should have been heralded as a shining example of how the FBI did it right, since no one died, there was no fire, there was no drama, it sort of fell off the radar screen. But I would say that was my most proud moments, in that there was a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean, it was one thing to be an internal critic of the organization and say, hey, you know, you should have paid attention to what we negotiators were telling you at Waco, and then having now an opportunity to do it the way we wanted to. We pretty well had to do it the right way and make sure we had the successful outcome that we were confident we would achieve, but we knew it would take time and a lot of patience and creativity. And again, we don't have the time to go into it, but I think we did some truly innovative things out there that helped to encourage the Freemen to come to the table and negotiate in earnest in a situation where for the first 2/3 of the event, they wouldn't even talk to us directly. We had to use intermediaries. So it had its own unique challenges, but patience, perseverance, creativity, a calm demeanor, and a thoughtful approach are the tools of the trade that we were able to fully exercise in Montana versus Waco, and the outcome showed it.
Amazing. There's a few things I want to draw out that I think were really interesting in both of those stories. In the first story about Waco, one of the things that you said was we were sending mixed messages. What was the cause of those mixed messages? Was it just an ego play between the negotiation team and the tactical team? Why were there mixed messages that were being sent?
I think it came down to personalities, Mark. I think I don't want to name him, but the commander of the tactical team at that time sort of was a living example of Maslow's commentary about if you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Right.
Several years before Waco, we had an incident at the Talladega prison in Alabama, and it began to unravel in the assessment of the negotiation team and everyone else. I was there, was that the inmates were going to start killing hostages. So the FBI's hostage rescue team, under his command, undertook a very successful and a very well-executed tactical rescue. And kudos for them. No shots were fired. They secured the prison safely, took back into custody the seven hostages and all the inmates. And I think what happened, I think the on-scene tactical commander came away from that experience with an inflated sense of his capability, because one situation that required tactical intervention ended successfully doesn't mean that that's the preferred course of action. I always tell people, we don't use force because we can. We use force in law enforcement only because we're left with no other alternative. That's the only acceptable criteria. But if you think you can handle every difficult situation with the use of force, then that becomes a dominant theme. So I think this particular commander became frustrated at what he perceived, not completely unjustified, that this at Waco was taking a long time. And David Koresh would renege on things he said. He would say one thing and do something else. He wouldn't always come through. He was a manipulative kind of guy. People like that are frustrating to deal with, but as negotiators, we're fairly used to dealing with people like that. But commanders of tactical teams don't necessarily have our experience and training in human behavior. So his frustration was manifested in his desire to, okay, these negotiators are mollycoddling this guy. This guy is manipulating the negotiators. I'm going to show them who's in charge out here and undertake some maneuvers that will send a different message and put the fear of God in them. And several of these were done without us even knowing about it. And that's embarrassing for the negotiation team. And
yeah, you mentioned in your book the loudspeaker campaign that they had.
Yeah,
can you explain that? What was that all about?
Yeah, I mean, we had set up loudspeakers for one particular purpose. We'd cut off their regular telephones, and to communicate with the civilians, we had military field phones that we had placed outside, and they picked them up and brought it inside. So when we wanted to call them, we would call them on the field phone and vice versa. Well, the armored vehicles that were used primarily to protect the tactical team, because this was an open field area, there was very little place for them to find secure cover. They would occasionally break those lines, with the tracked vehicles, and we would use the loudspeakers to say, hey, the line broke again. We're going to send another phone up. Please pick it up. Well, one evening, one of the on-scene commanders decided he was going to play some music and weird tapes he brought. I heard about it, and I went to the overall on-scene commander and said, we don't do that. We don't teach that. We don't agitation deprivation techniques. We just don't believe in them in the FBI. We've taught every police department in the country not to use them. And he said he would take care of it and make sure it wouldn't happen. Well, it happened anyway that night after I had gone to bed back to my hotel room for a few hours sleep. The next day, I protested pretty significantly, and he assured me it wouldn't happen again, but sure enough, it did. And finally, I had to prevail through back channel at headquarters to get it stopped. To me, it remains one of the most embarrassing aspects of Waco, because, you know, after Waco, I would do a lot of speaking on negotiation circuits. And of course, people assumed that the FBI would sort of led the business of hostage negotiation. Why would we employ this strategy that we'd always taught against? And, you know, I had to explain, well, not only was it a bad thing to do, but it was not done with the approval or support of the negotiation team. So that's one of the areas that's always been a sore point for me.
I find it super interesting to correlate your story. And I know in no way am I comparing like the risk of a hostage situation to the risk that's associated with business negotiations, but they're very, very similar in this experience, because there are executives in organizations that will just totally deviate from strategy that's outlined in a high-level negotiation and take sort of actions into their own hands after everything's been agreed to with the negotiation team. And that totally destroys the entire negotiation, but also the credibility that we had any hope of developing as a negotiation team. And now, not only do we have to build back that credibility, but we also have to like make up ground that we've lost in all of the discussions before. And oftentimes, it's virtually impossible to do that, because once you've set that kind of precedence, now the counterparty doesn't understand who they should and should not be talking to and who can and cannot be trusted. And so when that ends up happening, it completely eliminates, or I should say, it really reduces the probability of a successful outcome.
I couldn't agree more. After I retired from the FBI and was a consultant, I helped a major corporation put together a very comprehensive crisis management plan to respond to a variety of different incidents. And we spent a lot of time with them, and they had a great team, and we put together a stellar plan. And at the end of it, I was shocked when they said, this is great, but it will never work. And I was taken back and I said, well, why? And they said, because our CEO hasn't paid attention to any of this. And with his personality, he'll come in and do whatever he wants. He won't pay attention.
Yeah, wow.
And I said, that's really unfortunate. And I think you might see it in an American political situation right now. I mean, we have a president that can be counted on to sort of say and do what he thinks versus maybe what his team is recommending. So that can create a lot of problems. A team needs to be on one sheet of music. Everybody needs to be coordinated and sending the same message. You know, I used to have a colleague negotiator that used to say, negotiations is not just what we say on the phone. It's what they hear on the news. It's what they see flying over them. It's any stimulus that they have that impacts on the crisis site. And to the extent we can, we need to control that and make it as uniform as possible so we don't send mixed signals.
Yeah, because when they start to receive those mixed signals, it just confuses and muddies the issue. And then it becomes a much more complicated issue to be able to address. One thing that I love that you said, especially when I was starting to do research about the Freeman negotiation, I read some of your work on that and some additional articles. The one thing you talk about is patience. I mean, within how long was it? 86 days you mentioned?
I think it was 85, yeah.
85 days of essentially standoff, right? Negotiations. Mm-hmm. And you had to be really, really careful and really patient about how messages were delivered, how they were received, and all of that came into it. At a certain point, you guys must have felt frustration. How did you deal with that frustration when it came up?
No, I mean, that's a good question. And I always tried to run a team that was collegial and even fun. I mean, if you were to know my personality away from these sorts of interviews, I try to be a fairly humorous, lighthearted person. So you keep the atmosphere light. You try not to take yourselves too seriously. And you have to really embrace the serenity prayer. You know, you have to understand what you can change and what you can't. Mm. And that some things just take a lot of time and we have to be patient and not allow our disappointments to enter in how we engage with the people we're dealing with. Again, the self-control issue is so terribly critical. And, you know, I just watched a movie the other night with my wife. It's the new Tom Hanks movie about Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, brilliant.
And what a wonderful negotiator he would have been, because a couple things I noticed about the portrayal of Tom Hanks, which I think is spot on to the real Mr. Rogers, is when he was talking to you, you were the only person in the world. You were the most important person in the world. He was totally focused on you, and he asked very thoughtful, in-depth questions to find out what you were thinking and how you felt. And he did it in a likable, genuine way that you couldn't help but just love the man, you know, and feel this is somebody I want to work with and that I appreciate is sincere. You know, when I teach corporations now, I try to, rather than talk about the incidents I worked, I talk about what are the key communication attributes. It's likability, it's genuineness, it's sincerity, it's responsiveness. You know, a lot of the key words that you can put down, I use about a dozen of them to say, you know, this is what really makes the difference. In the negotiations, too often people want to go right to the heart of the deal and close the deal, when in reality, we've got to first create a positive relationship. And, you know, I think one of the attributes that so amazes me now, and I spend more and more time thinking about, is likability. What is it? How do you teach it? Can it be taught? But we all know somebody that we've met maybe for the first time at a social event or something else, and you just get the sense of, I really like that person. Let's go have a drink, or let's have dinner, or honey, let's invite them over to our house. And it's sort of a hard commodity to articulate, but it's really important, you know, that you get that likability by showing a genuine interest in other people and being patient and listening to what they have to say. And it's hard when you're focused on just trying to get down to business and get your way.
Yeah, I love that. Have you read Jack Schaefer's book, The Like Switch?
No, I haven't.
Brilliant. So he's a behavioral analyst from your area, FBI guy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is he's tried to create a formula for friendship and likability. And what he says is friendship equals proximity plus frequency plus duration plus intensity.
Very interesting
conversation about that, where he talks about, okay, if I'm closer to you, like proximity, and I increase the frequency, meaning we do it all the time, we have that duration, right? The longer I spend with you, the more that chances are that we're going to be liked. And if the intensity is there, meaning, you know, I'm actually showing that interest, like you mentioned about Mr. Rogers. So I'm showing that interest that I actually care about you. I'm genuine about that. I'm sincere about that. Then likability is created. And it just brilliant in the way that he describes it. And when you mentioned Mr. Rogers, I was like, that's exactly the, I mean, even the body language, you think of his tone of voice, the body language, all of that was built upon making you believe that you were the only person in the world that he was interested in speaking to.
Well, there's this wonderful line when the actor playing the reporter, Matthew Rhys, I guess is his name from The Americans, and he's talking to Mr. Rogers, and Mr. Rogers is played by Tom Hanks, says, "I've never met anyone like you before," you know, which is a true thing. We've all never met anyone like anyone else, you know, but the way he said it was, "I find you so interesting and so unique and so fascinating." And if you could walk away from hearing that, not feeling pretty special, you know, I don't know what it would take, but this likability thing, I mean, if you could put it in a jar and sell it, it would be pretty valuable for negotiations. Because I think even in the business context, I think people want to do business with people they like and trust and feel good about, even if you're the product that you're selling is perhaps a bit more expensive than competitors. They like the comfort zone of saying, you know, "I've done other interview shows, but I like the way Mark interviews me, and I just feel comfortable when he talks to me." And it may be hard to quantify or to describe, but you feel it, and it has real value.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. If it was just a logical argument, it's funny, I had a discussion about this earlier today with someone that, where they were like, "But you know, Mark, that's not necessarily true because I make all my decisions based on logic." And I was like, I don't think you do. I mean, I know that you think you do, but you actually don't. Because if it was purely a logical argument, I mean, there would be no reason for me to be talking to you right now.
Yeah,
just
I mean,
the math and make a decision, right? The reason we're talking is because you want to find out more. You want to find out who I am. You want to find out if I'm trustworthy. All of that kind of stuff comes into the decision.
And it's so much more than an analytical exercise.
I mean,
it's body language, it's appearance, it's that friendly smile, the way you engage. I mean, there's some people we just like almost immediately. And perhaps as nature's way of keeping us safe, there's other people that we're quite suspicious of right away. And I always used to tell when I taught some travel security issues for clients in the corporate world, I would say, you know, trust that instinct. I mean, if you're out there shopping overseas and you see somebody in the store that's looking at you funny, pay attention to that. You haven't analytically thought about it, but if you're getting this feeling, give it the respect it deserves and make sure this person's not unduly interested in you or potentially poses a risk or a harm. You know, just trust those instincts because they've evolved, you know, through millennium to keep us safe, I suppose,
right.
And we should pay attention to it. So, you know, every once in a while you get fooled. Every once in a while you'll, you know, in the United States, we joke about the used car salesman. And I think it's probably very unfair because all used car salesmen aren't the same. But when someone so immediately and quickly pretends to be your friend and to know what you want and what you need and displays a higher level of familiarity than they've earned yet, that's a turnoff for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's when your warning goes up, and that's when you become more resistant as a customer. You know, when I'm buying a car, I like the old guy that looks like Columbo, you know, that sits over in the corner and they walk over my way and say, "Hey, you look like you know what you're doing. You got any questions? I'm sitting over here. Just come find me and I'll help you if I can, you know, but I don't want to get in your face. Just enjoy the showroom, whatever." That's my guy. You know, that's the guy I'm going to when I buy the car because I like that style. I don't want somebody to follow me around the showroom and, you know, "How many kids you got? You know, what are you going to use the car for?" And so forth and so on. We're getting a little distant, but the point being that as human beings, we're sort of trained both from knowledge and experience that there's certain people that we like and want to work with, and there's other people that cause some question marks for us.
Yeah. People crave that genuine interaction, right? They crave sincerity because I think a lot of people can speak to the experience of just been lied to, you know, bold-faced lies about, "Oh, this is going to be fine. This is going to be amazing, blah, blah, blah." But if someone was just genuine with you and sincere about the process, then it's actually a lot easier to trust that person because they just seem more believable because they're not bullshitting you, at least that we perceive that they're not bullshitting us, right? So I think that's really important.
It's not always a matter of speed either, but I've always told people you have to earn the right to be of influence.
Yes.
You know, the behavioral change stairway that I developed in the FBI, it's used pretty broadly now. And the top step is basically gaining cooperation, changing the behavior of the person. And we do that through exercising influence. And we get up to that step through having rapport. And we get the rapport through demonstrating empathy and using active listening skills. So it's a process we go through, not by the numbers strictly, but just know that, you know, through my engagement with this other individual, through my contact with them, I need to show them that I appreciate them and understand. And I, in turn, am worthy of their respect. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's a key element to communication. And a lot of people, sadly, don't seem to understand that.
Yeah, I love that. To wrap up the conversation, if you could leave the listeners with one piece of advice that you wish people would consider when they're negotiating, what would it be?
One piece of advice, when I think of active listening skills, the two most frequently used are emotion labeling. You know, you sound angry, you seem upset. But what I really like is a good summary. I think it's an undertaught thing, or paraphrasing, but I think it's a little bit more than just a simple paraphrase. I think periodically demonstrate to whoever you're negotiating with that you understand what they have said, not only in terms of the content of what they said, but how they feel about it. So when you, I'll give an example. So Mark, you know, as you were telling me before, it's really important that you feel as though it's really important that when you meet a person that you take your time to understand them and to hear their point of view and to acknowledge their point. You know, it's like Stephen Covey says, first seek to understand and then be understood. Mm-hmm. So I think periodically employ a summarizing paraphrase, you know, put in your words what you've heard and what you see. And that is a powerful, powerful way to let somebody know, I've heard you, I understand you, not only what you're saying, but how you feel about it. There is no more powerful communication tool than that, in my opinion.
I love that. Fantastic. I love that you added the piece there, not just paraphrasing back the information, but understanding how the person feels about that. I think a lot of the time we forget that, and we could very easily ramp up the empathy and ramp up the trust if we did that in our negotiations. Gary, how can people find you online?
My website, www.garynesner.com, GARYNOESNER. And got my website with some of my presentations and some of the articles I've written and other things that certainly purchase my book. I don't sell my books, but shows you how to get them if you want through Amazon or whatever. And it's funny, Mark, you know, I've done three of them in the last couple of weeks. I will hear from a high school student from across the world saying, I'm doing a report on Waco. Could I talk to you? And I always say yes, you know, and I'm shocked and surprised. I mean, I just did with a young man from New Zealand the other day. He says, it's a school project. I've always been interested in Waco. I said, well, come on, I'll spend time on the phone with you. Always make to have a teacher or a parent there because I don't want any of those issues to come up. But I always want to know, I'm happy to help you any way I can. And I think that's how we should all be, particularly as you get older. You want to be a mentor, you want to make a contribution, and you want to help people in the world. And, you know, hopefully as we all get mature, we become a little bit better people.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on this show, sharing your wisdom with our listeners. I know that they greatly appreciate it. And so do I. So to you, I say thank you. Thank you for writing your story. I loved your book. I think it's fantastic. And again, just thank you for teaching us how we can get better at negotiation. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you again, Mark.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.